All right, everybody. It's Monday, July 16th. I'm very excited. My Broadway show, Permission to Speak with Paul Mercurio, opens tonight, 8 o'clock, runs through August 15th. It's at the Jerry Orbach Theater. Yes, that guy from Law & Order. Tickets are on sale on my website, paulmercurio.com. Just click on the ticket link there and use the code PMFAN, Paul Mercurio, PMFAN, and you get a discount. Nice big fat one, because I like the cut of your jib. It's a completely improvised show with the audience. As far as I'm aware, no one's done a show quite like this. Got a lot of other cool stuff going on with it. Really great set. It's really come together, so I hope you can make it. And enjoy my guests.
Hey, folks. Welcome to this week's podcast. Have a great guest on the line. Someone that I've admired for a long time and came out of sketch comedy out of New York City as a young lad. Kevin Allison, the creator and host of Risk podcast and live show that can be seen in New York City at the People's Improv Theater and in Los Angeles at Nerd Melt. Kevin, great to have you on the show. Thanks for doing this.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
The real reason I have you on is you're apparently an expert at bed bugs, so let's get into that right away. what's going on with the bed bugs? What's going on?
I'm sitting here, you know, I have a sound booth that I built into my apartment, and I don't build jack. Like, I don't have the ability to build things, but I actually managed to build this little sound booth in my living room, and now the thing is a hive for bugs because it's got all this soundproofing, right? So they hide underneath it. What I didn't realize is, you know, because I travel so much for Risk. So once a month or twice a month, I'm in another city like Dallas or Chicago or Austin or wherever doing the show there because we tour so much. And you end up in these little rinky-dink hotels. And I think, when you get bed bugs, you don't know if it's you or your next-door neighbors or the people downstairs. Like, they start just going all over your building. But I'm pretty sure I bought these suckers here.
Well, good for you for admitting that. A lot of people sort of rationalize it has to be somebody else. I am not a bed bug person, but you're totally owning it, which is really great.
I also I'm notorious for being like the ultimate like polyamorous sort of bachelor. So I also have a regular queue of young Asian men coming in. From various parts of Chinatown.
Well, there you go. Hey, you know, listen, my father always said, you want to have a fetish, you got to pay the price.
You definitely do. Having a fetish gets very complicated and extensive at certain points.
See, I like to stay with the that's why I stick with the boys from Czechoslovakia. They tend to be cleaner. They come from a colder environment where there aren't many bugs living. Then we just ship them back through a tunnel that hopefully we won't take out or the Israelis won't take out. But we went from bed bugs to the Middle East crisis. I don't know how that happened, but it's I want people to know what Risk is. It's a really in and of itself, it's a really cool thing. But as cool, or maybe even cooler, is how it came about and the history behind it. But explain to people, it's a storytelling show that you created, and it give people a little sample of what it is. And you had something in reading up a little bit about you more. It was an interesting quote of yours that I want to talk about, but I first want people to know what this show is.
Well, you know, there are a lot of storytelling shows now, especially in New York. In New York, it's kind of like the folk music scene in the 60s where like everyone was trying it. And it's like you don't necessarily have any experience as a stand-up comedian or a writer to give it a shot. But the thing that distinguishes Risk is that unlike some of the storytelling shows that you hear on NPR, like The Moth or This American Life or Snap Judgment, on Risk, Nothing is censored. You can talk about absolutely anything. We push people. When I'm helping people develop their stories for the show, I'm really digging into them, kind of like a therapist, to say, wait, is there another feeling under there? That kind of thing. So that people are really like bearing all. And some of the stories are just absolutely hilarious, and some are X-rated, and some are just like emotional, so emotionally raw that you still wouldn't hear it on NPR, you know, like just because it's so shocking. So it's great that it goes all those places that real life goes, but that you don't hear about talked about in the media so much. But the way it came about was, you know, I was in the States, the sketch comedy group on MTV in the early 90s. And when the group broke up, I didn't know what to do. So for 12 years, I was just a starving artist. I thought, oh, I know, I'll do sketch comedy as one person.
Well, you had Bedbugs. You had Bedbugs as a sketch partner.
That's right. They're great.
They don't eat a lot. They travel well. You don't have to get them their own hotel room.
They are not big now. They've probably been around since 96.
they're a prop act. They have a prop case that they take with them. So you're doing, and it's interesting because I know that you were, there's a great story here about Black, one of your fellow cast members in the state, really great comedian in his own right, who you sort of turned to at one point during this time of you're literally doing pretty outrageous characters on stage, like really going for it, apparently.
Yeah, these big, big sketch comedy kind of characters telling stories. And I did a show out in San Francisco, and I just felt like, man, I might as well be talking into a vacuum. I can't look into people's eyes and see anything happening. I can't feel like that electricity that you sometimes feel between yourself and the audience. And so I said to Michael Black, I was like, what do you think? What did you think of that show? And he said, look, I think you should drop the act and start speaking from the heart as yourself. Just tell your own stories. And I said, oh, my God, that scares me because I'm so gay and I'm so kinky and raunchy. But at the same time, I'm so Midwestern and polite. And, you know, I was raised a good Catholic boy. And like, I'm so absurd with my sense of humor that like all those things together seem too weird. And I said, it just seems too risky. And he said, that's the word. If something feels really risky, then you're probably opening up. And if you're opening up for real, the audience is going to open up. So the very next week, I came back to New York and I said, I'm going to try this. I was 39 at the time. So I was like, look, at this point, I'm willing to like either die poor or just, you know, go balls to the wall to do whatever that, you know, I think I fear most. So I got up on stage when I came back to New York at a storytelling show here. I had never done a storytelling show before. And I told the story of the first time I tried prostitution.
That was your first story out of the gate. Wow! When you go for it, you really go for it.
Yeah, this was right before the state was picked up on MTV. It was, you know, like we were just a bunch of kids. You know, we had no money and we didn't know how to do anything to make money. We were just waiting for the longest time to hear from MTV whether or not we had been picked up because we had already made our pilot. So one weekend I tried this and it was a disaster. I was not cut out for that line of work.
Did you make any money?
You know what? I did not. No, it was a complete and total bust. The evening was like,
wait a minute. Back up a minute. I don't want to be mean, but you can't get somebody to give you $5 if you give them a blowjob. How bad are you as a pro? You not find the dick? Like, what?
No, I wanted to make the rent. I didn't want to make $5. You know, I wanted to find like a sugar daddy.
Oh my God. Well, you are like a fair skin. You are like a fair skinned Midwestern blonde haired blue eyed guy. I would think there's like, a lot of guys would be attracted to that.
Well, no, what it was back then, this was, when this happened, it must have been 92 or 93, 93, I think. And so I was about 23 years old. And back then we had Hustler bars in New York City. This was, you know, before Giuliani shut all that kind of thing down. And so you would walk into those bars and it was like all these, everyone, you know, it was half and half. Half of the people looked like Rush Limbaugh, you know, these old guys who, you know, they looked like bison, and you knew they all owned banks. And then the rest, everyone looked like from My Own Private Idaho. They all looked like Keanu Reeves and River Phoenix, like these, and they had like just so much like arrogance and style, and they had these little like hand gestures they'd make to each other. So I was just like not up to it. I was just too much like the boy from Ohio who does not know what's going on. So no, I did not do well with that.
And how old were you when you came out of the closet? Were you in? Was it once you were at NYU in New York or before then?
No, well, you know, I came out to myself after seeing the movie E.T., of course.
Wow. We gotta get your mind to a university to have it studied, because there's stuff going on in there that only scientists can explain.
Gary, it was Stephen Hawking.
So look into your head and go, Stephen Hawking's going to look into your brain and go, I have no idea what to make of this.
This is another universe. Yeah. It was, that was 1982 and I was 12 years old and I felt jealous of the little brown alien because I was, I liked the boy in it so much. The kid Elliot who befriends E.T., I had a crush on him. So,
oh, interesting.
So I walked away from that movie for everyone, it was like a friendship movie, but for me, it was kind of like a love story. And I walked away like, oh my gosh, that was such a bizarre reaction I had to that. I have to admit to myself. And so I said it out loud. And you have to understand, I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio, where it's like, this is a town that has a violently anti-sexual attitude.
Yeah.
The most conservative city north of the Mason-Dixon line, I think. Very, very, it's a big Republican stronghold. And like Larry Flint loves Cincinnati because he knows he can go there and get people all riled up about something. The Mapplethorpe trials were there. So there's always something going on there. It's like, what? Sex happened? No. So I did that. And for example, in my own family, like my mother's kind of puritanical attitude, like really contributed to what I do today. Like, for example, I remember I read the book. There was a book called Once a Catholic, which was interviews with people who were raised Catholics. And one of the people interviewed was George Carlin. And he said, you know, I'm so thankful that I was raised Catholic because my parents were very cool. But they sent me to these really strict Catholic schools. And there I was introduced to this culture that I found so bizarre and insane that it was the thing I started rebelling against. And in rebelling, I started to find out who I was. So I kind of feel like rebelling against the attitudes of Cincinnati towards sex in general and my mother towards sex in general, and then the larger attitudes of society in general about gay people.
Yeah.
Is a large part of like what forms what I do now with Risk. It's not like all stories told on Risk are about sex, but it's like Risk is a place where people like come out about the other.
It's sort of like this is maybe a very bad analogy, but we have a son and he has a friend whose mother is a bit of a Nazi about sweets, right? The poor kid's idea of like a fun night is he can put salt on his brown rice that he's having with salmon. Wait, I get salt? It's Salt Thursday? Woo! So what happens is when he comes to our house, we have cookies in our house and we have ice cream. We don't, it's not 24/7 that we eat it, but like, and then what he does is he gorges on it because he doesn't get it in moderation in other places. And I would imagine in some weird way, this is sort of what's happened with you, right? You were so repressed in some way in Cincinnati that it sort of became part of your DNA that you express yourself and see others express themselves. Because if you don't, it just ends up in, I think, drug use or alcoholism or you're suicide or God knows what if you keep it inside. So could it have been some of that, that this is sort of, you know, once you got loose with this, you needed to stay loose with it?
Oh, absolutely. I think that, you know, like even in my 40s, like since I started Risk, like people will dare me to do things because of the nature, like fans will write in like, hey, have you ever thought of maybe taking a trip to yada yada? And at one point someone was like, hey, I know about this tank camp where you go for like 4 days and it's an actual camp out in the woods. And it's, you know, there are all kinds of workshops and parties and orgies and everything where you learn about every kind of kinky thing under the sun. And do you want to come along with me? And I was like, oh, I actually, even though I've told stories about sex on the show, I actually don't know anything about BDSM. I don't know anything about the real, you know, the real hardcore stuff. And this guy said to me, well, then take a risk. So I did. I was like, oh, my gosh. Okay. It's like the show is now speaking back to me. So I did. And what was so interesting, it came at the right time in my life because I had been more or less married to a man for 9 years, and then that had recently ended. So it was a great time to be like, oh, yeah, let's start exploring sexuality again. And that weekend made a total kinkster out of me.
So up to that point, you had been your sort of middle-of-the-road sex person when it came to sex, but it may like it kind of, you know, whatever, you did sort of the standard stuff and then you brought it to the next level after that weekend.
I used to, you know, for me the kinkiest thing that I would do was that I would often go to sex clubs, I would often go to gay orgy sort of places, but here was a place where people were like doing like really intense role playing with fire or, you know, like electric cattle prods or whips or chains.
Does that actually get a person? I know it gets people aroused. Have you ever used any of that? Has it gotten you aroused? Do you really get off on that?
Oh, absolutely. It's fascinating that there's several episodes of Risk where I did radio style stories. That means stories that aren't told in front of a live audience, but are just the person speaking into a microphone with music and sound design added. And one is called one's called Kevin Goes to Kink Camp. That's like an hour and a half long story. And then another is called Beyond Kink Camp. And those are my first dipping my toe into this kind of stuff. And what it is I just kept being astounded to find, oh my gosh, this is turning me on. Even though I might not even have an erection or I might not come, like, you know, I might be in a situation that's like transformative in some other way, but still really, really hot.
You mean emotionally transformative or freeing or some, in what sense, if you can?
Absolutely. Like in the story Beyond Kink Camp, I had this experience with this young guy, a Chinese guy, who tied me up and blindfolded me and like was really, you know, kind of using me like a slave, doing whatever he wanted with me. And at one point he like shoved my head into his boot and he was like, I got to do something. You just stay there and smell my boot for a while. And it was so funny because in that moment here, I was like inhaling like his boot, which smelled feety, you know, and everything and finding like, oh my gosh, this is so weird. I find this comforting. I find this like a kid with a security blanket because I'm so entranced by the magnetism, the sort of like mastery of this guy. you know, a lot of it's going on just, a lot of it's just going on in your head, and a lot of it is going on in role play. A lot of it's like a lot of
there is actually.
Oh, go on.
No. Go ahead. Go ahead. Finish your thought.
Oh, I was going to say a lot of BDSM is a lot like improv, like comedic improv, you know, the high status character and the low status character. And just like going with the flow and being like, holy crap, I didn't know that I would kind of dig communicating this way.
So a couple of questions. One, do you have the Chinese guy's phone number? And I wear orthotics, so I don't know if that would be weird if I put your head in your face in my shoe. You'll see orthotics. That might be a little weird. But you talk about the group stuff to me. You know, I've always been intrigued by that. I'm heterosexual, but and they have that same kind of thing for heterosexuals. But I'm not trying to be funny here. I would feel, even though I'm a performer, I would feel intimidated, and then I'd start, on some level, I cannot keep my opinions to myself. I'd start probably commenting, criticizing people during the sex, and you don't need to hear that, you know what I mean? Like, you don't need me commenting on what you're doing. Was it something you took to right away, or did you have to get adjusted to sort of being in a group dynamic and exposing yourself literally and figuratively like that?
Oh, well, it's interesting because the group thing I got acclimated to really soon after moving to New York City. And I tell this story. There's a story I tell about graduation day from NYU. At some point while I was in NYU, another gay guy let me know that there was this place called the Limelight in New York.
Sixth Avenue.
Yes. 6th Avenue and 21st Street. It was an old church that had been turned into a nightclub. And I think it was Thursday nights was gay night there. And the church literally had a steeple, like, you know, that you would walk, like, kind of like in the movie Vertigo, you would walk up this winding staircase, up into the bell tower. And that room where the bell used to be was just this totally kind of dark and shadowy room where men would do whatever with one another. There were always lots of condoms and lots of lube and stuff like that sitting around. And so that to me, when I was, oh gosh, maybe 18, 19, 20 years old, was where I started feeling most comfortable with having sex, in that weird sort of primal man-to-man, like, group environment where anything goes. It's kind of like a little bit of a journey into the unconscious because everything's dark and anything goes. And what kind of screwed me up about it was that I felt so much more comfortable there than I did at gay bars or on dates.
Really?
Yeah. Because
why is that? you have, it's hilarious. You have intimacy issues, but in a completely different context.
Absolutely. I do. It's like when it comes to being naked and being, you know, physically intimate with people, I go into kind of like an primal animal kind of, you know, it comes to me like whatever, like ABC. But when I have to like present myself on a date, I always
because you have to be emotionally engaged, and that's in some level harder and more difficult for people than to just be physically engaged and then you walk away and you're done, right?
Well, what I feel is that on dates, people want you to be masked. People want you to be putting on a little bit of an act, like, I'm going to have to make you guess what my flaws are while I am as charming as I can possibly be. And I have to admit, another reason that I think I've succeeded at Risk is that, that creating the show Risk, is that I've got and almost shoot myself in the foot habit of being too exposed, you know, of like, for example, I'm the kind of guy, if I'm stoned or on mushrooms or something like that, I'll tell you right away, oh, I'm stoned. So if I say, you know what I mean?
I should not break the law with you in the car.
Hey, officer, I'm fucked up. Woo! Exactly.
You want to hit a THC?
Exactly.
Oh, my God. So why do you think this is common thread through all of this, of just this need to just bare your soul and bare your body, no pun intended, sort of on any level? Like, what is it, going back to feeling as a repressed Catholic, which I know is kind of cliche, but going back to Cincinnati, I mean, I think we're all informed by the way we were brought up, but is it that?
No, you know what it is? I know exactly what it is. It's that most people, become conscious about their sexuality in around about, say, freshman year of high school, somewhere in there. I was aware that I liked boys, and specifically that I liked boys' butts. that was right there, right from the beginning.
I have a very flat ass, by the way. I'm just telling you, I have a flat ass. So when we see each other, you're going to be like, I can't do anything to get my ass to be round. I've done squats. I run. It's flat and it's getting a little hairy now. But, you know, it is.
You know what? Can you do? I have a story about that. It's called It's Tough to Be an Assless Man. I come from a long line of Scots with no asses. And I think that's why I like asses so much, because it's what I don't have.
we all want what we can't have.
That's right, exactly. Because when I was a little kid, I was literally 5 years old when I convinced my friend to take his pants off and show me, you know, what was happening between his cheeks and all that kind of stuff.
Jesus. Are you why Megan's Law was written? Oh my God!
Am I what? What's this?
Are you why Megan's Law was written?
That's 5 years old.
I was five at the time. I'm not. You were the youngest pedophile I've ever met. Good for you.
We were the same age.
That's hilarious. Oh my God, that's too much. So you knew? I mean, you. You knew, at least subconsciously you knew.
Not even subconsciously. I remember, because I knew what the word gay meant and I knew what the word fag meant when I was five. And I remember thinking, oh my God, I am so terrified about going to kindergarten next year, because what if people find out about this? And I remember first day of kindergarten, we're waiting in a single file line to enter the building. We weren't even, you know, they arranged everyone on the playground beforehand, and then we were going to enter into our separate classes. And someone pointed to my head, to my hair, and was like, oh, his hair is orange. And someone else said, no, it's red. It's red. It's like the head on the dick of a dog. And they started laughing at me. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, that's awesome. They're making fun. They're making fun of my red hair. Maybe that will distract them from what's really weird about me.
You think this is weird? Get a load of this.
Exactly right.
Oh my God. And so, but that's going to be hard for the next 10 years. I mean, I don't know when you officially came out, but that's got to be hard to, I've always wondered, and I've never asked someone who's gay this, but it's got to be incredibly distracting to be in the closet, right? Because you're constantly on some level on guard, and that never goes away, I would imagine.
Absolutely. You have so many conversations that are just like,
crazily ironic, you know,
like in the grade school and high school years for me, you know, all the going along with jokes and like having to do this, that. And in fact, I remember when I was in the eighth grade, I took some summer school classes at the high school that I was going to attend the next year. And there was a statue of St. Francis Xavier, because I was about to go to Xavier High School, in the grotto behind the high school. And I remember, I don't know, it's praying, because, you know, I was raised very Catholic. And I remember praying at that time, when I go into freshman year, I want to stop this whole going along with the jokes and pretending I like girls, you know. I'm not necessarily ready to say I like boys, but please help me to like stop the awfulness of pretending that I like girls, because that's a little bit too that's, you know, a lot of psychological energy that it takes out on someone who is prone to be super honest, right? And I did end up coming out to some of my friends in the first couple of years of high school, and it didn't go well.
What happened?
I lost the first two people I came out to. First one was like around eighth grade. The second one was around end of freshman year. Those friends just like deserted me after I came out to them. So I was a typical, like, you know, like, I think most people in comedy have something in their youth where they felt like, oh my gosh, I'm weird in such and such a way. And so I had to compensate for that by being funny and whatever, you know, like fun to be around, right? So, and another way I thought of it was that because my humor was always a little bit like absurd and a little bit like off the wall, I always felt like that was a way of like warning people there's something weird about me, but I'm okay, you know, but I'm still nice and friendly. And I feel like I'm still doing that today. You know, whenever I bring risk to a new city, I'll tell the first story of the evening, and it'll usually be a kind of a kinky, crazy sex story, but that's also funny and friendly, so that people feel like, oh, this is a safe space to talk about anything, and then they're ready for the next person to get up and say,
well, and I did.
The funny thing is, I never had the big trauma that so many people on the show talk about, you know, like it was just, my thing was purely that I understood myself at too young an age. Yeah.
Well, I think that you in particular, setting the table, obviously because it's your show, makes sense, though, because you are so likable, and you literally could probably say just about the worst thing a human being's ever said. you have an infectious laugh, and you're very likable and a sweet guy, and I'd be like, yeah, all right, well, he wants to fuck me, he's got head lice, no problem, what the fuck, why not?
Right.
By the way, have you ever turned down a fetish? Like, have you ever been in a moment where you're like, oh, that's too weird even for me, sex-wise? And if so, what was it?
As far as sex goes?
Yeah, you've ever been in a situation, a gaggle of guys, suggest something, somebody wants to do something, and you're like, nah, that's a little too going over the
line. Oh, yeah. Well, we've had stories on the show. One of the best episodes of Risk ever is called Slave. And it's Melina Williams, who is a black woman. And she talks about how she developed this kink for playing a Southern plantation slave to men who enjoyed acting like racist cracker plantation slave owners, and like getting really serious about like recreating that psychological, whatever, that dynamic. And
I have had, because I'm so attracted to Asian guys, I have had guys approach me and want me to be Mr. White, dominant, imperialist, like insulting them for their race. And what I've literally told them is, I don't think I could maintain a hard-on speaking like a Republican.
Oh, that's brilliant. What if you had a sack of gold coins while you were doing it? Maybe that might help. We had a lot of money in front of you, a great stock portfolio. Maybe that'll give you a hard on.
The amazing thing is that I really do. I have to admit, like when people say, like, because on the kink sites now, everyone lists the kinks that they're into, and I have to include race play because I actually enjoy being the white man who is bowing to the King of Siam or the last emperor or whatever. Right. So it's like, I'll do race play, but it has to be the other way around.
I'd rather have you snuff me out than be the ones doing the snuffing.
Right, exactly.
Do you, in this sort of extreme world of fetish, if, for lack of a better term, do you find... Have you, and have you discussed this with others who do this, that you've discovered things about yourself as a person that have helped you be better in relationships one-on-one? Like, it sounds like you're a person that likes to be dominated at times. Do you find then you're in one, and when you're in real relationships in life, that you tend to be the more submissive one in the relationship with your partner?
Well, it's interesting because what I ended up doing, like this kink camp that I first went to, it's called the actual name of it is Dark Odyssey, and they do several camp events per year. And this happens to be the first year where my schedule with Risk has just, I can't go. But they've invited me back to actually teach classes. And so one of the classes that I teach is called Secrets of a Sweet Dom, because when I do dominate people, I tend to be kind of like the tough, loving coach, you know, the guy who is going to be maybe rough on you and push you, but it's also going to be like super supportive and like, you know, tell you you're doing a great job and like really kind of ultimately love you. Like a daddy, you know?
Right.
And it's interesting, when I've taught this class, I invite people to take it to, you know, share their own experiences. And it's interesting. It's mostly what I've experienced is it's mostly because these camps are like every gender, every orientation, every, you know, trans people, whatever. But it's mostly male-female couples, heterosexual couples, where the male is used to being a sweet dom toward his female partner. And it's really, like, there's something really, really sweet about hearing their take on how they make that work, you know? I find this kind of stuff, like, endlessly interesting. Like, we tend to be very binary about everything. You know, you're either a top or a bottom, or gay or straight, or this, that, or the other. You know, whereas like real experience between people tends to be a little bit more fluid, and that's what fascinates me. When tables start to slightly turn, that kind of thing.
And do you find now that relationships, because of this world of fetish that you explore, does it help you in relationships with people, in both romantic or friendships?
Well, it's difficult to say because I'm early into this. Like my relationship with my husband ended, and we're still legally married because we're too lazy to pay the $500 to get divorced.
Well, obviously, you need that money to get the bed bug situation cleaned up. So
I
don't have money for a divorce. I got fucking bed bugs. God damn it.
I think I'm still too new into this whole kinky, out of the closet as being more polyamorous. I've never been a monogamous kind of person. I've never had a monogamous relationship. Even my relationship with my husband was open, at least. If not, it was open, but not poly. Polyamory means you can actually have dates and go out, have dinner and movies with other people. But my husband and I was just, you can have sex with other people, which is a whole different thing, just purely casual stuff. But, I'm still, even at the age of 44, trying to figure out where I fit on this spectrum. And it kind of depends. It kind of depends from relationship to relationship, because you can't really, you can declare that I feel like a poly person, right? Or I feel like I'm an open relationship kind of person. But both of those declarations are going to come into a trial period when you actually enter into a serious relationship with anyone else. I have friends who are always saying, don't date outside your species, which means if you sense that another person is just like hardwired to be monogamous, and you are kind of hardwired to be an open relationship sort, you probably should avoid dating them. But most people are a little bit in the gray area because, from relationship to relationship, things are slightly different depending on the chemistry.
Do you think that the gay community has a higher percentage of people who are open to the idea of open relationships versus the heterosexual community?
Definitely. Sociologists say that at least 50% of gay men are completely open, whether or not they're married or not, or in a long-time companions or whatever, they're open. And
I wonder why, because that doesn't surprise me that there's an enlightened view, if you will, of relationships about that sort of thing. Why do you think that is?
I think it has to do with the difference between men and women. I think that, it's really, really hard to nail down these things because they're very stereotypical. But I think it can be said that there's something about testosterone that makes men a little bit more able to see purely, I think that men are just more okay with casual encounters. And those casual encounters can often be quite intimate in their own way. You know what I mean? Like, for example, when I was with Ariel, the sex... Oh, I mean my husband. he would be okay if I mentioned his real name. But anyway, during the 9 years that we were together, the sex that we had was extraordinarily unique. It was its own thing because of the chemistry between us, because there was a unique relationship there.
Unique in the sense that it was intense, that it was unique in what way?
It was emotional, like it was different every time we had sex because it was emotional based on whatever the hell was going on between the two of us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what
That's
I mean?
Right.
These little intimate encounters with other people, like for example, one night, Ariel and I, we had a rule. If you're going to have sex with someone else, you should make every effort to alert the other partner before it happens. And if that's impossible, like if you're at a club and it's, you know, like you can't get to your phone or whatever, then you should at least let the other partner know right after it happens, right? So one night I go to this club in Queens, which is like a, you know, big like gay orgy kind of space. And I met this deaf guy, this deaf Japanese guy who was a masseuse. And we had this like amazing encounter with each other in this little room. Here's another like irony about me. Whenever I go to an orgy situation, I focus on one person and that's it.
Oh, that's hilarious. You're the worst orgy guy ever. I can hear the other orgy guy, people in the orgy go, who are you saying? Kevin, what is it that you don't get about the concept of an orgy? What? You cannot be in a corner with another guy. It's a group thing. Hello? Oh, that's so funny.
I like the feel. I like the feel that there's sex happening elsewhere in the room, but I still like to just have a thing with one person, right? So I can't get over that.
Do you get more turned on by being watched or by watching others?
Oh, gosh, I would say being watched for sure. Like, yeah, there's definitely an exhibitionistic side to me. Yeah. But at the same time, it kind of depends on what the other person wants as well. I mean, I'm just, yeah. If the other person is like, no, let's go into this. Because most of the gay sex clubs or the, you know, orgy spaces give you the option of going into a little closet-sized room of your own. Right. And in this case, it was this Japanese guy I got together with. He could not speak and he could not hear, but he could make sign language to me, even though I don't understand sign language, you know. So we had this conversation and this understanding between each other, which was kind of beautiful. And he was a masseuse, so he was amazing with his ability to do whatever, you know, the things he was doing. And I remember calling my husband. I had to call my husband, like, immediately upon exiting the club because I hadn't had my phone before. And just, like, detailing for him what had happened and how it made me feel and what this guy was. And I knew I was never going to see this guy again. But for some reason, to me, when you're in a relationship like that, the whole don't ask, don't tell thing, which a lot of people seem to, like, buy into for that kind of thing, that just ultimately doesn't work for me. For me,
I don't know. I don't know that I'd want to know. I don't know. Like, what do you gain out of it by telling him? Doesn't he hang up and feel jealous and vice versa? Like, doesn't he feel threatened? Doesn't he feel? I mean, look. I think it's admirable that you guys could be so open with each other. I think the world would be a better place if everybody could be as open as that. I think that takes a lot of courage and a lot of security. I don't know that I could get there, to be honest with you, because I'd be like, she was with a guy, you know, hotter than me, blah, 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 whatever. Like, how does that work? How do you make that work in your own mind?
Here's the deal, and this is the story that I've yet to tell for Risk. And it's the story I've yet to tell for Risk because the stories that I worry most about telling are the ones that I feel are going to challenge me the most. You know what I mean? The stories where I feel like, oh my gosh, I come off as such a clueless asshole in the story. that I'm a little bit devastated to even be sharing it, right? But those are right. also often, like, when I finally, like, sit down and I'm like, all right, I'm going to do this, those are usually the best stories, the ones where you really dig into yourself. So I asked my husband a couple of years ago, I was like, is it okay if I tell the story of our 9-year relationship? And he gave me total carte blanche. And I said, no. I would want to send you a recording so that you could, you know, say how comfortable you were with it first. He was like, I don't even need that. I trust you. And that was, like, really amazing for me to hear.
Yeah, that is.
But I still feel like I would want to do that. But what it ultimately came down to is that it was when both he and I broke the rules of our polyamory that everything fell apart. It was like within the same couple of months, I had unsafe sex with someone at one of those clubs. And he had been dating someone. He had been, like, going out to movies and staying over someone's place and having dinners and yada, yada, yada. And so we had both been cheating on the rules that we had both understood for years. And that was what brought the house of cards down. So when we went to it, like, we decided we're going to get divorced. And I said, listen, whatever we do, we have to be as kind and compassionate to each other during this divorce process so that we're still friends afterwards. Because the thing I think is the most tragic is when people have had real profound intimacy with each other for a long period of time and then are just like, that's the end of my relationship with that person completely. You know what I mean? I mean, I think that that's...
It is sad. Especially when kids are involved. It's really sad. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I really don't think it's a failure when a relationship ends, but I think it is a little bit of a failure if the relationship ends and the people aren't allowed to at least, like, be kind to one another afterwards. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's funny you should say that because I'll put a relationship ending, like a divorce, under the word, in big capital letters, quitting. And the reason I'm doing that is I recently had Bobcat Goldthwait on my show. And he's been on Risk too. Yeah, he's great, right? And he talks about, there's a great quote of his. It's like, he goes, if you're not happy where you are, quit. Quit hard, quit often. Eventually, you'll end up in a place where you're supposed to be, and that'll be a really happy place. And he says in the show, he says, you know, a lot of people would equate quitting with failure and giving up. And sometimes it's just okay to just say, I want to make a change, and that's a healthy thing. And that sounds like where you guys are. Like, you figured out a way to quit the relationship, but not in a negative way, which is great.
And you know what? I feel the same way about some of my professional decisions. Like, there was a part of me that really wanted to quit being a sketch comedian. And what I realized is I didn't have to quit completely. I could still be a funny person who was making, you know, crazy, right, absurdist observations and whatever, but just in a slightly different format. I think that, like, so many, I'm always advising people, if people are interested in a career in comedy or just the performing arts, to try this, try that, try the other. Take a lot of workshops because you never know how it might start coming together for you. And something that you thought you were a total failure at before actually did kind of train you how to handle such and such a minor part of the new thing that you found that you can do.
Yeah, no, it's true because, you know, when I started doing stand-up, you know, you start doing jokes, and then I started to have these episodes in my life, you know, like I'm sitting around a friend's house or Thanksgiving dinner, I just didn't think of even much of this story. I just was starting to tell the story of how I almost got arrested for pulling my pants down on 86th Street over a plastic supermarket shopping bag. And I went ballistic. And my friend, it's a true story. I have a tendency to sort of speak my mind, and I think I'm going to change the world, and I get into these things, and my wife's like, you got to figure out a better way to deal with people in life. And I'm like, I'm kind of this, you know, especially in consumer situations, I'm like this bizarre superhero in my mind that's going to fight for the rights of consumers. And so I get into these confrontations, and they escalate to a point where it's not good for anybody. And my friends are like, they were on the floor laughing, and I started to just talk about my life more. And in my act, to the point where that's all I do now, and it's so much more rewarding because it's not an act. It's literally, like, half the stories, they're not even written. I literally tell them as they happen. They don't even have to be embellished. And there's something really freeing about that. And there is a transformation that happened in a good way from being one kind of performer to another kind of performer. So I totally get that, like, wanting to shed one skin as a sketch artist and move into this other world.
Yeah, and to the audience, it might not be so very clear what you've changed. You know, like, a lot of people might not notice what changed for Louis between, you know, in the whatever early 90s and now. But, you know, he certainly knows what changed. And you can, you know, anyone who really studies this kind of thing can see, oh, he's really digging into his real life now. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, because he was very absurdist, you know. He used to do bits like, you know, I love Short Order Cook, the diner waiters, the waitresses, the way they order. And then he'd do this, like, rant, of, like, yeah, I want a sloppy Joe on an ice cream cone and a hemorrhoid to go. And then he just, and all it was a collection of bizarre words. It wasn't even a structured bit, but it was funny. And then that was going to come to him now.
Absolutely. I have to say, I loved him back then. You know, it's fascinating. Like, it's very, you know, it's a perfect example of a person trying out stuff where later, you know, because let's face it, let's not make it a binary thing. It's not like he was absurdist before and now he's pure realness. You know, it's like he was more that way before. He's more this way now. But where he was before totally informs and helps him, you know, add nuances to what he does now.
Yeah, and I think that there's two kinds of comedic performers, and maybe more than two, but there's the one that locks into an act that sells tickets and they know it works. And then there's another one that's more the artist that sort of, the act has to reflect who they are. They just can't help themselves. And sort of wherever that takes them, it takes them. And so the commerce part of it is secondary to them, you know, and they're the ones that are constantly changing their act and growing and move on, and they get married, or they have kids, or they're in relationships with significant others, and that all that's reflected in their act. And that's the beautiful thing about whether it's sketch comedy or stand-up comedy or storytelling. I think it all falls under the same umbrella. And the other thing that people should know is there's a great story that I'd like you to tell about a father that wrote to you about his son being on drugs, and they happened to listen to one of your episodes, that it's not just all kinky and fetish. It's people coming on with humorous stories, bizarre stories, kink stories, but also sort of clutching stories that are making a difference. I thought that was fascinating. And tell people a little bit about that.
Oh, yeah. There was an episode called Under the Influence. And unfortunately, we're about to hit 200 episodes. And it's hard to keep that many episodes on iTunes or lives in our original server. So Under the Influence there was some hilarious stories. There was Al Madrigal talking about accidentally giving his elderly cleaning lady cookies laced with LSD. That's a hilarious story. But there was also a story on there about a young comedian who had just won the Andy Kaufman Award and whose sister had, like, 6 months earlier died of a
cocaine overdose. And he shared so, the way he shared about it was just so raw. And so, like, he was sharing, like, I always encourage people on risk to focus on specific incidents, to, like, focus on a specific conversation or a specific moment where you really remember how you felt inside your body and that sort of thing. And he was doing a great job of that. But at the same time, he was just, like, really reacting in the moment grief. And that story was a stunner. And it was about 2 weeks after we had released it, I got an email from a father who said, listen, I have been a huge fan of your show from the very beginning. And I always felt like there was something special about this show, that people, you know, are able to say things here that they can't say other places. But My son, my 18-year-old son, has you know, been on heroin for several years now, and it's just getting worse and worse. And the two of us were not able to relate to each other over the years, especially about this issue that we, you know, I knew about, he knew about, and we were classical. And so one night, I was like, look, maybe I can sit him down and have him listen to this episode. This episode that goes through hilarious, wonderful, heartwarming things that happen to people on drugs and awful, horrible, devastating things that happen to people on drugs. And he said that his son listened to the whole episode with him. And it was like the most like father-son thing they had shared in the longest time. And afterwards, after he heard the final story, the story about the guy whose sister had died of a cocaine overdose, he said his son was, like, ready to start giving up heroin. And that was the evening that shifted everything. So when I hear stories like that, you know, for example, people in the state, I spent years during those 12 years that I was starving. I spent a lot of that time very resentful and jealous about people in the state who were, you know, making millions. But now I've got this show where people write emails like that to me. And I'm like, okay, I'm doing fine now, money-wise, but it's really that. It's really that, those emails from people that make me feel like, okay, wow, I'm on the right track. I've got something going.
Yeah.
Here, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you know, that jealousy thing and that envy thing, we all have that in any walk of life. I think particularly performers, and Bobcat actually talked about that too.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when he let that go, he just felt unburdened. And how did you finally come to terms with that? Because it's not like you're not successful in your own right. Obviously you are, but I understand what you're saying. You know, you're home and you see one of your ex sketch mates on TV every night or whatever, or, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's like, how'd you come to terms with that? Because sometimes people don't come to terms with it and they jump off a bridge or they get sucked up in drugs and alcohol. Like,
That's right. One of the stories that I really want to work on is when I, one night when I was having panic attacks and really, really, really wanted to jump off the Williamsburg Bridge. I haven't yet worked on that story. That was about when I was 30. That's a very fascinating turning point in my life because I was in therapy at the time. And the therapist thought that I should leave the performing arts. The therapist thought that I should stop comedy because she said, comedy is frivolous. What you should do is write a great American novel. And so I kind of colluded because the thing about therapy is the patient has a lot more control in many cases than they think, especially if the patient is a good storyteller.
Control.
Because
how so?
Because the truth is that when I was 30, I was so desperate and so resentful of seeing my friend's success and so confused about how I was supposed to be presenting myself in the realm of the performing arts that I kind of convinced her that maybe I should leave the stage and become, say, a professor of whatever, literature, and, you know, like kind of like hide in the ivory tower. So I got a job in publishing. I did leave for about 4 years. And that's another story. There are so many stories that I've yet to tell on Risk. One of the things I've been dealing with lately is that because Risk and the Story Studio are businesses, I've had to focus so much on running the businesses that I've stopped creating new stories. And that's troublesome. You know, I'm relying too much on the old stories from the beginning, and it's time. I think when I move into this new apartment, I think I'm seeing it as an era to start telling the new stories, you know?
And yeah, but I know what you're talking about. Go ahead. A lot of that is what?
A lot of that is going to be new self-evaluation, you know?
Yeah. Did you have the Story Studio, and people should know you essentially teach storytelling, not just to performers in the arts, but business people and, you know, just anybody from any walk of life who need help in that skill. What is the common thing, the trap that people fall in and when they first start trying to tell stories? What is the biggest hurdle that you have to get people to overcome, if there is one or two of the sort of common things that you have to deal with initially in working with somebody?
The biggest one is that people tend to stick to what I call narrative summary, which is pure explanation, speaking of things in a purely conceptual, intellectual way, in a broad overview. Whereas what we're really interested in a story is when a person can zero in on a particular incident and speak of a sight that they saw, or a sound that they heard, or an actual quoted piece of dialogue that happened. Or a feeling that they felt in their guts or their throat. So it's teaching people to recognize that if you zero in on certain dramatic moments when you were most emotional and kind of slow down the narrative at that point, you can really paint the fuller picture in a more cinematic way that really grabs people's attention. And most people are kind of shy about doing that. And the reason they're shy about doing that is because they have to kind of relive the emotion of the experience at that moment. They have to kind of go through a little bit of sense memory. And sometimes sense memory can be a little bit like,
And when you combine that with the fact that for those emotional moments to really be impactful, they have to breathe, which means you have to allow silences. It's very difficult to stand up there, even if you've been doing it a long time, and sit with the silence. And that's when it's the most powerful. And, other comedians that I've talked to and performers about this as well, takes people, some people don't ever get there. Some people, and you know what I'm talking about, like they just got to constantly keep talking. They got to keep filling the space, and there's no place for the piece to breathe. And when you get a newbie up there, that combined with the fact of what you just said can be deadly in terms of a story being effective, I would imagine.
Yes, absolutely. People who are kind of counting on laughs, because laughs are the signal from the audience that most let us know you're doing okay. We're laughing, so you're doing okay. But those moments in the story that are more profound or more emotional are not going to have laughs. And so feels more uncomfortable to go there for the storyteller, which is one of the reasons that we do include more of the radio-style stories in the episodes of Ritz as well, because when a person is just sitting in my apartment prior to my having bed bugs and speaking into speaking into my microphone while I'm just sitting across from them like a therapist, they're bound to say things that are just a little bit more intimate. And I talked to Mark Maron about this because shortly after I did the Kevin Goes to King Camp episode, I talked to Mark. Mark and I actually recorded an episode for his podcast, but that got fucked up, and so it's never been on, so I've got to do it again with him sometime. But he said, I said to him, it's interesting to me to learn that when I just sit in this little recording booth of mine and speak into the microphone and just pretend I'm speaking to people that I care about, things will come out of me that I might not be comfortable saying in front of an audience. And he said, yes. He said, that's true. And if you keep doing that, it'll make you be a little bit more able to do it in front of an audience as well.
Yeah.
And I thought that that was a very profound point to make.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's fascinating. And the stories, just for people who may not have heard them, they can be fairly short in length or they can be long. Like it runs the gamut, right? In terms of story length, generally.
Oh, absolutely. Stories on Risk, some have been 5 minutes, some have been an entire hour, or an hour and a half and split into two episodes. So we're very flexible about the length. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, so what are some episodes that are coming up or that you'd love to get people to come see or, tune into on the podcast that you're excited about?
Risk is every fourth Thursday in New York and Los Angeles. We're at The Pit, the People's Improv Theater in New York, and we're at Nerd Melt in Los Angeles. But we've also got shows coming up on August 29th in Austin and September 17th in Portland and September 18th in San Francisco. So lots of stuff coming up. We're always kind of running around the place.
Okay. Well, people can find you online. If people want to learn how to tell stories, you are the guy that they should go to, particularly if they have some kinky fetishes or bed bugs going on in their life. You're the guy to get it out of them. This has been utterly, utterly fascinating and entertaining and fun and funny and all the things a conversation should be, thanks to you. I really appreciate you being on, and go see Kevin, listen to Risk, and check out the show in one of the cities he mentioned, and we'll see you next week.
All right, that was Kevin Allison, one of the seminal comedians coming out of New York comedy scene with the state, and it's always got some really cool stuff going on. And hope you can make it to my Broadway show. Starts tonight, goes through August 15th. It's at the Jerry Orbach Theater. Tickets are on sale through my website, paulmercurio.com. Click on the link for tickets. Hope to see you there. Bring roses and throw them at me. That's what you're supposed to do.